So you're having some stomach issues or a persistent migraine that just won't go away. You go to the doctor, probably doctors, and after a multitude of tests, they say, oh, nothing's wrong. But you're in pain. You know that something is causing it. It also may be that you were sexually or verbally abused as a child, or perhaps you witnessed an act of violence that you never reconciled. That trauma may not be unrelated to your stomach and headache issues. Josh Mirsky thinks that that is the case. He believes that something called trauma-informed care could help improve outcomes. Mirsky is a professor of social work at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and he's also founding co-director of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. He's speaking at UW-Milwaukee's Trauma in Our Community Summit happening this Wednesday, June 20th. Josh Mirsky, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much, Carrie.
We're going to take your calls this hour, 800-642-1234. You can email us about trauma-informed care at ideas@WPR.org. You can tweet us at WPR Morning. So, mornings, actually. So let's start with this, Josh. What exactly is trauma?
It's a great question, Carrie, and I should acknowledge that there is no single definition of trauma, but you could go back to the ancient Greeks if you want to, and they regarded trauma, it literally means wound, it translates as wound. Perhaps in a modern context, though, the most widely accepted definition of trauma comes from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And in brief, they regard trauma as an event, a series of events, or a set of circumstances that people can experience as physically or emotionally harmful. And it's thought that these events, whether it's a single event, a series of events, or a set of conditions, that the harm is not only short-lived, but that it is also potentially long-lasting. In other words, trauma can have lasting effects on people's physical, mental, and emotional well-being over the life course.
So something like horribly bad doesn't necessarily need to happen to you. You might just grow up in incredibly stressful circumstances. Racism could be trauma. What is just going on in the world that is affecting you could be traumatizing you.
That's exactly right. So, we, of course, have to be careful with, sort of how we define things, and we don't want to be too loose with our definitions. But what you're saying is exactly right, that it's not just very concrete and direct immediate events that have implications for our health and well-being. Simply the environment in which we live, the water in which we swim, as they say, can have significant implications for our health and well-being. There is a related concept called the social determinants of health, and basically, they've shown through research that simply by virtue of living in an unjust or unequal society, as a function of living in conditions where you, for example, don't have access to good schools or good jobs, that can actually have deleterious effects on your health.
Hmm. What are these long-term deleterious effects?
It's a great question. They are numerous. Basically, if you pick a bad outcome, whether it is physical, mental, emotional, or spiritual, you can probably find a connection to trauma. Some of the best evidence of this comes from research that's been done on adverse childhood experiences. Adverse childhood experiences include events like physical abuse and neglect, as well as sexual abuse, and various forms of household dysfunction. For example, growing up in a household where there was domestic violence, or growing up in a household where there was substance abuse. These things, when they occur in childhood, they tend to have a cumulative effect, and research has shown that the more adverse childhood experiences to which you're exposed, the greater your likelihood of experiencing any number of long-term poor health outcomes, including things like stroke, chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, and even cancer. They've linked those types of long-term health outcomes to things that happen to you, bad things that happen when you're 5 or 10 years old. And again, the message is that the research has shown that the more of those things that you experience, the worse your health outcomes tend to be.
So how many people are we talking about in the U.S. who have grown up in these kinds of circumstances who are affected by this?
Right. So one of the real contributions of the adverse childhood experiences literature, and this all started really back in the mid-1990s, one of the great contributions of this research has been to demonstrate that these experiences are not rare. Trauma is not a rare event in our communities. In fact, it's quite common once you define trauma in the way that we do now, which is not just singular events, but also conditions in which we live. So the ACE literature has shown that at least half of U.S. adults report experiencing at least one adverse childhood experience. In the state of Wisconsin, for example, there's been a great deal of work gathering information statewide through the Behavioral and Risk Factor Surveillance System. And it's shown that well over half, roughly 58% of Wisconsin adults report experiencing at least one ACE.
Interesting. We are talking about trauma and the trauma-informed care that doctors are starting to figure out. One of the questions I have for you, though, is, okay, if about half the population is affected, we can't choose our parents. We can't choose that our parents might have a violent relationship or substance abuse or both. What do we do to deal with this trauma before it starts giving us cancer and stroke and increased risk for heart attack?
Well, there's the $64,000 question, Carrie. Mm-hmm. So there's no one simple answer to what you're asking, but what I'll say is that, first off, this is the very focus of the Trauma in Our Community Conference that we'll be holding here this week. And it's really where the field is going. We have no shortage of evidence to demonstrate that trauma is prevalent and consequential. What's lacking, though, at this point are real concrete solutions to what we can do about it. Certainly, the trauma-informed care movement has done a great job of outlining principles that we can apply to help improve our communities, to enhance the organizations that we work in and the communities in which we live. But we're hoping through our work at the Institute for Child and Family Wellbeing and through our collaboration with many other community actors that we partner with here to concretize identify more practical solutions for how we can actually address trauma in our community.
We are talking about trauma-informed care. Liz in Portage emailed us to say, this sounds like a great approach and one we don't have time for. Everyone has suffered trauma of some sort, but do doctors really have time to spend talking to us about our past and figuring out the connection?
Great question and a critique, I would add, and it's one that I share. And so let's take, for example, primary care settings. The critique is exactly right. Doctors simply don't have time to sit and provide psychotherapy, right? They have a limited amount of time, and frankly, their primary focus is going to be whatever the presenting health condition is. That said, there are specific things that can be done within a primary care setting to potentially contribute to solutions to the problem. So, for example, one of what we would call the key practice elements of trauma-informed care is screening and assessment. In other words, what's something that we can do to address trauma? Well, quite simply, we can ask questions about it. We can ask questions about trauma exposure. In other words, what kinds of experiences have you had in your life, adverse and negative experiences? In addition, we can ask questions about what we would call trauma symptomatology, right? So symptoms that are typically linked to trauma, such as post-traumatic stress disorder. And there are, throughout the country, people are beginning to work on creating brief screening tools that can be integrated into primary care. And then the point of that, then, is not that doctors will necessarily have to sit down and do something with that information. However, by gathering that information, it accomplishes two things. One, it can help the patients potentially make a connection between the symptoms that they're experiencing and past or even present conditions in their life. And secondly, that information, after it's gathered, can potentially be used to refer patients for additional services as needed, for example, evidence-based mental health services.
We are talking about trauma-informed care, which asks what has happened to you rather than what is wrong with you. We're going to be taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. What do you think trauma-informed care is, and could it help you or have helped you? It's The Morning Show. You're listening to The Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We're talking about how trauma affects children and adults and how a newer movement that's underway could help improve their outcomes. We're talking about that with Josh Mirsky. He's founding co-director of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. He's also a keynote speaker at UW-Milwaukee's Trauma in Our Community Summit, which is happening this Wednesday, June 20th. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. I'm going to share with you, Josh, an email that Vern in Stanley, actually he called to ask, doesn't this approach run the risk of missing problems that could be helped by standardized medical treatment and medication?
Could you repeat the question for me?
He says his question is essentially, is trauma-informed care in place of standard medical treatment and medication?
That's a good question. In brief, I would say no. Really, what a trauma-informed approach is about, it's really much more so of a systemic and even policy-level approach than it is, say, for example, a direct clinical practice. So trauma-informed care has been put forth as really a set of principles. It's a set of principles that guide the approaches for how we interface with people in professional settings. So some of these principles include things like promoting safety, wanting to ensure that, for example, when patients present for care, that they feel safe in the environment in which they seek care, approaching people with trustworthiness and transparency. So in other words, it's not designed to in any way replace, you know, evidence-based medicine or psychopharmacology. Rather, it's merely meant to enhance the way we go about our business when working with trauma-exposed populations.
We are talking about trauma-informed care, which is a new way that doctors are looking at old health conditions, seeing that they may have been informed by trauma that you've experienced in your life. Michelle from Madison, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me. So, Josh, I am, I had already said earlier, I feel like I'm a poster child for what you're talking about right now. Experience some pretty severe childhood trauma between the ages of 12 and 16, of, you know, the abusive sort. Right now I'm 36. I have pretty big issues with general anxiety disorder. I take anxiety medication, and to help handle anxiety since having a child and a high responsibility job, I do see a cognitive behavioral therapist to help with this. How I personally know, I feel strongly that what I've had to deal with has impacted what I'm currently trying to handle with anxiety right now. But it's not really touched on too much in my current treatment. What my question is how would my treatment and what I'm doing right now differ in a trauma-based treatment?
Wow. Michelle, that's a great question. Josh, can you answer that question?
It was a great question. And Michelle, first off, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. So I would say that by no means would I suggest that the treatment that you're currently receiving is in any way unsatisfactory, and hopefully it's been very helpful. What I might suggest, though, is that if the therapeutic approach that your counselor is currently using doesn't currently address trauma, your trauma history, there may be some good reason for you to actually engage with your therapist in discussing your past. And of course, again, I am not a psychotherapist, and I don't want to dispense advice in this area. But what I will say is that a trauma-informed, or better yet, a trauma-focused therapeutic approach would acknowledge that in all likelihood, some of the symptoms that you are experiencing today can be tied to your past experiences of childhood trauma. And part of what a therapeutic approach would entail then would be identifying those experiences, being able to verbalize them, acknowledge them, and then hopefully working to sort of unwind that connection, resolve that connection between those precipitating events, those experiences of trauma, and their connections to your current symptoms. So, for example, as a result of those kinds of traumatic experiences, you may have developed certain kinds of coping mechanisms. Those coping mechanisms could be psychological in nature, in other words, the way you think or feel. They could be behavioral in nature, for example, the things that you eat or the things that you drink, your sleeping patterns, etc. And by making the connections between your past and your present, potentially you can identify more adaptive coping mechanisms moving forward.
Thank you, Michelle, for asking that question. Josh, I want to follow up on that, because it seems to me that this could be an intergenerational thing, that people often experience trauma because their parents experience trauma, and yeah. it just kind of gets passed along. And the other thing is just in terms of, well, first of all, let's address that right now. How do we deal with that intergenerational issue?
Well, you've really touched on an important topic, Carrie, and it's one I could talk about at length if time permitted. But there is increasing interest in the field to understand what you're talking about, those intergenerational mechanisms of effect, right, and how we might interrupt the intergenerational transmission of trauma. Right. So the basic notion, as you've already articulated, is that when we experience trauma in our lives, that influences in ways that we may pass along those same kinds of experiences to our offspring. And there's a number of really good reasons why we think that those mechanisms exist. So, for example, There is a concept called historical trauma, and this was developed by a scholar by the name of Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart. And she basically put to paper what indigenous peoples in the United States have been recounting for generations, which is that the effects of genocide and forced displacement and any number of tragedies that that Native peoples in the U.S. have experienced collectively, that has a recurring effect, that those effects have been passed along generation after generation. And what's really interesting is that these intergenerational effects are not just passed along at the social or cultural level. In other words, they're not just passed along based on stories that were told or even behaviors that we engage in. There's actually really good evidence emerging in the field of epigenetics that suggests that there are actually biological and genetic mechanisms that help to explain why things that happen to us in our lives might be passed along to subsequent generations.
In our biology, in our genetics.
That's exactly right. So the epigenome is essentially a layer of that lies just outside of our DNA, and it includes a lot of complex terminology that I don't exactly understand, and I don't think your listeners care to hear about. But essentially, what the epigenome does is it serves as a mediator. It mediates how our DNA is expressed. So, and the thing about the epigenome is, unlike our DNA, our epigenome can be modified as a function of our experiences. And if we experience lots of trauma or assaults to our epigenome, that will then influence how our DNA is expressed. It might turn on certain genes or turn off other genes. It can also amplify genes or mute certain genes, right? And it influences the timing of DNA expression as well.
So my other question is that I have had a friend who died of cancer. I also know that person dealt with trauma in her early life. It never occurred to me that there could be a connection, but there could be a connection.
That's right. Certainly the now famous adverse childhood experiences study found a connection between childhood trauma and an increased risk of cancer. What I'll say, though, is and I apologize because I'm a researcher, I do like to caution your listeners to distinguish between correlation and causation.
Right.
I'm not here to say that trauma causes cancer. That is simply not the case. However, there is some evidence to suggest that exposure to adversity and trauma, particularly during childhood, might increase our risk of cancer. In other words, it increases the likelihood or the risk of poor outcomes like cancer. It doesn't necessarily cause them.
And so if I have had childhood trauma, it might behoove me to go to a doctor earlier than maybe the recommended cancer screenings tell me to.
That is an interesting notion, Carrie, and one I hadn't really thought of. I don't think we are there yet with the science of trauma to suggest that, for example, we should tailor our screening recommendations for prostate cancer or breast cancer based on one's environmental profile. Certainly, there's a lot of interest in precision medicine. And perhaps in the future we may move in that direction, but I don't think that's where we are just yet.
We are talking to Josh Mirsky about trauma and trauma-informed care. Are you somebody who has dealt with trauma in your life, and are you seeing health effects from that? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sarah from Zion, Illinois, welcome to the program. Sarah?
Oh, hi. I'm so sorry. Yes. Thank you very much. I did experience quite serious childhood trauma. I have had serious health effects as a result. But now, not in my mid-50s, I'm like in this massive arc of recovery after like intensive thinking about it in therapy. And I wanted to ask you about what you said about the epigenetics. So, because I've been asking myself like my whole life, why is this child abuse so widespread in society? And so in light of what you said about the genetics, if everybody could get therapy who was experienced trauma, would that be enough to interrupt the cycle and solve the problem?
Thank you, Sarah. Good question. Josh?
Sarah, again, thank you for calling in and sharing your story. So so the field of epigenetics is certainly an exciting one from a scientific standpoint, and it does have a great degree of potential to enhance our therapies, both for trauma-exposed and non-traumatized populations. In fact, there are any number of epigenetic drugs on the market that are designed to target the epigenome and reduce the risk of cancer. But as I suggested before, it's probably a bit premature to suggest that we're at the place right now where simply by virtue of knowing someone's epigenetic profile, if you will, and then, if people were to then receive the kind of therapeutic support that you've received, that we could potentially, remediate trauma worldwide and interrupt the intergenerational cycle of trauma. But just to reiterate, the epigenetics of things is really an exciting frontier of this work. And what's perhaps most intriguing about it, and to your question, Sarah, is that epigenetics is one potential way in which we can understand how biology and genetics contributes to the perpetuation of the effects of trauma across generations.
You just said, Josh, that there have been some epigenetic medications that have been developed or are being developed. Our next caller, Maddie, actually has a question about that. Maddie, welcome to the program.
Hello. I guess it's my personal belief that most health problems are caused by something that entered into our bodies. But one word that you stated when you were talking was that it would be taken care of by evidence-based, medication or whatever. And usually when that term evidence-based is applied, it leads to enrichment of the pharmaceutical companies. And that is a concern that I have.
Okay, Maddie, thank you very much. Is this just a ploy to enrich pharmaceutical companies, Josh?
Well, Maddie, again, thank you for calling in, and certainly let me disclose that I have no relationships with any pharmaceutical companies. But your point is well taken. When we invoke the term evidence-based, you could make the argument that it creates an uneven playing field, which is that only certain organizations or certain systems have the capacity to and have the funding to conduct the kind of research needed to demonstrate that a particular therapeutic protocol, whether it's whether we're talking about pharmacological or psychotherapeutic interventions, only certain individuals and groups have the ability to conduct the kind of research to then classify their approaches as evidence-based. On the other hand, I do want to help explain why we sometimes use the term evidence-based or empirically informed. And the reason is quite simple, which is that in the absence of evidence, it is quite easy to refute the type of approaches that we use. And so while we can't always, for any given problem, there may not be an, a quote-unquote evidence-based approach, or there may be many evidence-based approaches, I would recommend that when possible, we choose approaches that have some scientific underpinning to them. In other words, and this doesn't just apply to trauma, of course. Certainly, if someone was going to, they had heart disease and they were going to going into surgery, certainly you would want your cardiologist to be using the best scientific practices that had been established through through medicine, as opposed to using interventions that we hoped were efficacious.
We are talking about how trauma impacts development and how we can better care for those affected by trauma. We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Have you or someone you know benefited from trauma-informed care? As a principal, do you generally think this is sound? We'll be back after a moment. Morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. With us today is Josh Mirsky. Josh is a professor of social work at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and he is studying trauma-informed care. Call us to talk about trauma-informed care, 1-800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Monica from Madison, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Josh. I wondered if you might comment on resiliency-promoting factors that schools, communities, and families can offer when clinical services, like mental health services, might be short. So, for example, in smaller communities, rural communities where psychotherapy is hard to access, things like social connections, experience of mastery, creative expression, cultural identity, those kinds of things in promoting wellness and living beyond trauma. Can you come on to that, please?
Resiliency, Josh.
Well, thank you, Monica, for your question. And what I really like about what you're talking about is that we can't simply look to our formal health and mental health systems to help solve this riddle. And it harkens back to what I was talking about before with respect to the social determinants of health. We need complementary strategies, I would argue, to reshape and reconfigure how we live on a daily basis in our communities. And so that means thinking about how our schools are structured, how our neighborhoods are devised, the quality of access to resources and various services in our community, things like transportation, things like architecture, things you might not necessarily link to trauma, but that can actually be connected to it. Now, with respect to the concept of resilience, there is really good evidence to suggest that one of the best predictors of whether someone bounces back from traumatic events is the support system that they have in place. Simply having one strong personal connection with another human being, whether that is a parent, a sibling, a teacher, that has been demonstrated to be a what we would call a protective factor. It helps to protect against or buffer against assaults we might experience in our daily lives.
I should note, thank you for that question, Monica. I should note that our state and city governments here in Wisconsin are pretty much behind this. An online fact sheet from the Office of Governor Scott Walker says that Wisconsin is leading nationally in its recognition and incorporation of trauma-informed care. Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has instituted trauma-informed care for firefighters and police officers in Milwaukee. So our government is kind of moving forward. Are you seeing this in other states, Josh?
Absolutely. So this is a nationwide movement, and certainly Wisconsin deserves great credit for working to be out in front on this issue. Lady Tonette Walker has been a champion of trauma-informed care. Governor Walker has helped to establish the Office of Children's Mental Health, which addresses trauma and promotes trauma-informed care. And so we're seeing great things here in Wisconsin as well as nationwide. That said, there's always more work to be done. And, you know, my work tends to focus on, again, not just trauma-informed care principles and promoting public awareness, but also thinking through how we can redesign our health and human service systems to integrate the best practices that we have available so that our systems and our services are trauma-responsive.
We are taking your calls and talking about trauma-informed care this Monday morning, 800-642-1234. Mike in Green Bay, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me on. I had a question. When I think of ACEs as those adverse childhood experiences, I generally tend to think of that as an emotional trauma. So is there a difference between this emotional trauma or physical trauma? At what age are you seeing the correlation between those increased risks later in life and the age of this trauma? What's kind of the cutoff? And then does it matter really how that trauma is handled when a child experiences it and the correlation to the risks later in
life? That's a great question, Mike. So when a child experiences, I'm going to go backwards. When a child experiences trauma, if it is handled at the moment, does it decrease risk of developing issues later in life? Is there a shelf life in terms of do you have to be under a certain age for it to impact you even greater? Josh, you want to deal with that?
Right. So there's a twofold question in there, at least as far as I heard. And thank you, Mike, for your question. So first of all, Mike's question related to the developmental timing of events. And then secondly, he was interested in whether sort of the protective factors that are in place or even formal interventions, the timing of those interventions, will that then affect an individual's outcome? So first, with respect to the timing of events or the timing of conditions, what I'll say first is that trauma or adversity experienced at any point in the life course can be potentially harmful or potentially traumatic, and there's good evidence to support that. There are, however, some conceptual and empirical reasons to suspect that the earlier that we experience adversity or trauma, the worse the effects tend to be. Now, again, this is we're not talking about absolutes here, but on average, when trauma is experienced during childhood, and say as compared to adulthood, and even more so when trauma is experienced very early in childhood, those assaults tend to have alpha effect on one's development and functioning over the life course. And there's good reasons for that. This is the point in life in which development unfolds most rapidly. Our neurobiological systems, our social, emotional, and cognitive systems are developing rapidly early in the life course. And when we are exposed to conditions that deviate from what we would consider to be an average expected environment, we can expect that those conditions will have a significant impact when they happen early in the life course. Now, secondly, the implication of that is that when it comes to intervention, of course, intervention at any point in time can always help to promote resilience and recovery. But the evidence would suggest that in terms of effectiveness and even cost effectiveness, interventions that are directed early in the life course, investments early in the life course, tend to pay off more so in terms of the health and well-being of our society, as well as in terms of return on investment. In other words, when we spend money on interventions that occur immediately after a trauma, and particularly when that occurs early in the life course, that tends to be, on average, the best approach.
We are talking about trauma-informed care. How trauma actually impacts people's lives. Have you experienced trauma? Are you now experiencing some sort of physical or a mental issue that you're realizing might be related to your trauma? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Aaron from Oconomowoc, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Hi, Josh. Two quick questions for you. I'm wondering, first of all, have you come across anything that compares the diagnosis and treatment of a serious illness to trauma? I'm a licensed professional counselor in oncology, and a lot of times I'll work with patients who have gone through a cancer experience and really compare that experience to a trauma, and often talk about how they just kind of went into survival mode to get through all the chemotherapies. And then just a quick second question would be, I'd be curious to hear about your experience or opinion with EMDR. I also have a lot of people who just kind of swear by that as a therapy. I don't have a lot of experience in it myself, but I'm kind of intrigued by that. So thank you.
Thank you, Aaron. So interesting turnaround that he's asking here. We're saying, or you're saying, that trauma may affect you so that you might get cancer. And he's saying that getting cancer is traumatic in and of itself.
Right. And so so there's a twofold question in there. One is sort of the linking of certain diagnoses or treatments to trauma. At least that's what I heard. And what I would suggest is that, you know, trauma doesn't have a direct connection to something like cancer. Of course, what it has is it acknowledges that an indirect connection to cancer. So if trauma is associated with cancer, it would be through indirect mechanisms like stress, for example, as well as, say, behaviors. People who experience trauma may engage in certain health risk behaviors like smoking, like poor eating habits, that increase their risk of later life health problems. And in terms of the diagnosis of cancer itself being traumatic, well, that makes absolute sense. And there are other related experiences that we may not necessarily think about as traumatic, but that can be potentially example. Experiencing a miscarriage, or there's even evidence that suggests that roughly 10% of women experience trauma during the delivery of a child, during labor. So that's definitely a possibility. Now, secondly, the question about EMDR, this is sort of a fascinating story, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds here, but eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. This is a quote-unquote evidence-based therapeutic approach that's used to treat anxiety disorders, for example. It was developed by Francine Shapiro. And it is widely used in the field, and it is considered a good practice. What I will say is that there's a big debate about EMDR as to whether the specific ingredient in EMDR that distinguish it. So in other words, the bilateral movement of the eyes, or asking people to hear sounds bilaterally in both ears, There's a lot of debate as to whether those ingredients that make EMDR unique are actually active ingredients or whether they're inert ingredients. Some have argued that there's really not good evidence that there's anything unique about EMDR, and what does work is actually based on a therapeutic approach that's been around much longer, which is called exposure therapy.
Okay, so we are getting into the weeds here. I want to kind of pull us out of that a little bit.
Yeah,
we
sure.
are talking about trauma-informed care. Ivy from Evansville has a really interesting question. Ivy, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. My dad was a veteran of World War II. He was at St. Lo, Normandy, and Volt. And he suffered from PTSD, as we realize now. And he never talked about it. He held it in, and he was ill. And he ended up dying of multiple myeloma. And at the time, I was 22, and I swear it had to be related to the stress. If it didn't cause it, it made him less able to fight any kind of diseases. And he didn't smoke, and he didn't, drink, but he had high blood pressure and probably didn't eat well. But, yeah, it was, and it also passed on some stress to my brother in particular, being a boy, and me watching the relationship. So thank you.
Thank you, Ivy. Josh, war is stressful. War causes trauma. And we've only recently started dealing with that idea that PTSD is a thing.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because although the PTSD diagnosis has only been around for a couple of generations, it's been recognized for well over a century that war produces these kinds of effects. One thing I found interesting that Ivy mentioned, and thank you, Ivy, for your call, is that PTSD itself, one of the reasons why it's such a pernicious disorder is because it leads to certain avoidance behavior. So that's one of the classic hallmark traits of PTSD is that because we experience these negative symptoms, we tend to avoid environments that trigger those symptoms. And yet it's actually through exposure to those symptoms, which is why I mentioned exposure therapy earlier, it's actually exposure to those symptoms in a graduated and controlled environment that can actually help to remediate the symptoms of PTSD.
Josh Mirsky is a professor of social work at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. He's also a founding co-director of the Institute for Child and Family Well-Being. We have been talking today about trauma-informed care. We could probably go on for another hour. Josh, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Carrie.
The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Bultina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is the Ideas Network.